part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. It's the third Thursday of the month, the day we talk about computers. Peter Kimball is with us this afternoon. He's joining us to take your telephone calls and answer your questions. Peter is the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. Listeners, you can join us with a telephone call. Your questions about computers are invited this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL. Peter, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you, and happy St. Patrick's Day.
And the same to you. Where would you like to start today?
Well, it's a day for the wearing of the green, so I thought maybe we would talk about how people can protect some of their green online.
Okay, that sounds like a good idea.
There are, of course, increasing publicity about the sophistication of some of the schemes and scams that try to separate people from their green or from their money, including a lot of emphasis these days on so-called phishing sites, that's spelled with a PH rather than an F, which pretend to be legitimate sites and try to trick somebody into entering credit card information. Oftentimes you receive emails that purport to be from a bank, from eBay, from PayPal or something that says something on the order of, we've discovered some unauthorized activity on your account, or there's a certain charge. We need to make sure that this is not really yours. Will you please follow the link to the site? And if you follow the link to that site, what you'll find is a site that these days looks very much like the real site. It's very difficult to tell that it's not the official site. And of course, if you enter your credit card information or you enter anything else in terms of identifying yourself, social security number, bank account numbers, all the rest, under the guise of proving who you are so that they can be more secure, what you're doing is you're giving it to the crooks. And apparently this is starting to be more sophisticated in large part because organized crime is getting into this now. It's worth billions of dollars per year, which is pretty significant.
I've gotten these fishy emails, and they look good.
They do look good. The time was when you could look at these things and you'd find a number of errors in grammar and spelling and such, and there's still some of that, but some of it is actually quite well done. A number of the email programs now, Eudora for one, and I believe the new version of Outlook, or the one that will soon be out, will warn you if you are about to click on a link that says it's going to, you know, firstbank.com, but actually is redirected someplace else. It will warn you of that. So that's one thing to be aware of. And the other thing that I wanted to mention, this is not really in the area of fraud protection as much, but just overall internet protection. A lot of people are starting to feel a little bit uncomfortable about, even if it's a legitimate site, putting in their credit card number and such. All right, maybe this is a legitimate site, but how do I know that they are going to protect this as well? You read about all of these firms that have break-ins, hackers breaking into their site, and not to deface the website, but to steal all of the information that they have on file. And if they happen to have your credit card number on file, then that could be a problem. So a number of credit card companies, in particular, I think the first one to pioneer this was Citibank, which is an issuer of many credit cards, now has something available at no extra cost for anybody who is a Citibank cardholder called virtual credit cards. You get a little downloadable program. You can do it via the web, but it's just a little download that you get from the Citibank site. And then if you're about to make an online purchase, what you can do is bring up this, just click on the little virtual credit card icon. You identify yourself, name and a password, and all the rest. It's all via secure connection. And then you have the option to generate a single-use credit card number. It's only good for one use by one company, and you can even put a limit on it in terms of how much it can be spent. So if you're about to buy something online that's $30, you can specify. I always make it a little bit more in case there's a slight change. So I'll say, all right, I'll generate a credit card number for $35. It can be used once. If anybody else gets that number, it does them no good. It simply is invalid. If the company that I send it to tries to use it twice, it's no good the second time. And if they try to use it for more than the amount that I've specified, it will be declined. And then the credit card statement comes back to you at the end of the month from your credit card company, and all of those charges are listed with the official virtual one-time use number that was there. So I've actually had that. I was dealing with a firm that, you know, I think they were on the up and up, but not quite as ethical as I wanted to deal with. I was kind of foolish, and I was trying to buy some software, and I was looking at the prices, and here was this place that had it for $5 less. So I said, okay, I'll do it for $5 less. Well, I get an email, and I give them this virtual card number, all via the website, of course. And I get an email the next day saying, there's a slight problem with this order. You know, please give us a call, and here's an 800 number. Well, that's a typical come-on to try to get a high-pressure sales. You really need to buy this along with that, et cetera, et cetera, kind of a bait-and-switch thing. So I didn't want to deal with that at all. So I just said, cancel, you know, wrote an email back saying, I could have ordered this, you know, from PC Connection or CDW or any place and had it. It's $5 more. So just cancel it. But I also went, since they had not yet applied the credit card, I went to the, brought up the virtual credit card software, Applet, and canceled that card since it hadn't been used. Canceled that number. Okay, I'm fine. The next day, I get another email from this company that I canceled the order with saying, there's a problem. We tried to submit your credit card number and it came back as expired. Now, that email came back from them after I had sent them email saying I didn't want it, and they tried to go ahead and slip it through and ship it anyway. So saved me a fair amount of hassle, because in the meantime, I'd ordered it from a legitimate company.
Yeah. I would imagine that other credit card issuing banks would be interested in this as well. I guess your experiences with Citibank.
Right.
But
simply because I happen to have a Citibank-issued card. And I suspect that most of them are going to do things like that. Citibank happens to call it, I think, virtual card numbers or something of that sort.
Interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and we're talking about computers this afternoon. It's the third Thursday of the month, the day we take up the topic, computers and you. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455 333-WILL 800-222-WILL. Well, let's continue on this idea.
Saving of the green?
Yeah.
Or spending of the green.
Spending of the green. That's sure enough easy to do. Protecting it is a little bit more complicated. Any other ideas you got?
Well, this comes under the heading of common sense, everything that your mother would have told you had your mother been connected to the Internet years ago. It's that kind of motherly advice. And part of it is, ironically enough, never click on an attachment that your mother sent you unless you know that your mother was going to send it to you and you've checked to make sure that she's sent it to you, because what happens if anybody, it doesn't even have to have come from your mother, anybody whose machine might have been compromised because they hadn't applied software patches or they had a virus or any other thing, much of the techniques that those malware, malicious software packages do is they will look through the address book and they'll pick out a from address and a to address and attach their little payload to it and send that email out, and so it will look like it came from your mother or whomever, somebody you trust, to you. There'll be an attachment there. Hey, Mom wouldn't send me anything back. Well, your mom may never have known it, and it may not be her computer. So unfortunately, it's to the point that you really have to be careful. If you've got good antivirus software, there's a good chance that it'll catch 99% of that, but you still need to have some due caution.
Okay. Let's talk with the listener. A caller on line four, the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. I was wondering, I have a question on software. It's on money. Would he want to answer a question like that?
Well, I can listen to it, and if I can answer it, I will. And if not, perhaps I could refer you someplace else.
Okay. You know, you set up information that's on important records and organizer.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, it has a place in their accounts and loans, and there's like 10 places to enter. And I would think that there would be some way to add spaces to that.
I would think so. Money is not a program that I use directly.
Okay.
So I'm not going to be able to address it specifically. I assume that you have done such things, two things. First, of course, is to try the help that's actually with the software itself, bring down the help menu.
Yeah, I've tried that.
And they search, try something like adding accounts or adding entries or something of that sort. The second thing you can do is you can actually go to the website. Microsoft, for example, with Microsoft Money, has, with many of their software packages, has community forums. And if you get into the support area, it's like a giant bulletin board, and you can post your question and then come back in a day or so, and others of the thousands or tens of thousands who use the software, and many thousands of which keep an eye on those bulletin boards, may well have responded to your question and tell you, oh, you can do this or that. So those community bulletin board resources that most software manufacturers will have, and certainly Microsoft does, are a wonderful resource. The third choice, which involves spending a little bit more money and isn't necessarily as guaranteed of success, is to check one of the local bookstores for some of the more comprehensive reference books on using money, because as you well know, there's not a really good manual that comes with software these days. So in the order that I listed them, that's pretty much what I would do. It sounds like you've done number one. So check the online resources at the website, post a question, and if that fails or you don't get a satisfactory answer, try just skimming through a book in one of the bookstores.
Okay, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. No one waiting at the moment.
They're all out celebrating St. Patrick's Day.
I guess.
Painting the, dyeing the river green.
Yeah, or drinking that famous brew.
Yes, but hopefully not drinking the green river water.
No. Something we talked about some time ago, and maybe it would bear revisiting, is what happens when your computer essentially is kidnapped and it is a zombie machine. How do you know that has happened, and what do you do about it?
Well, it may be fairly obvious that something is wrong, or it may not. I'll kind of give the general description. When your machine is kidnapped or becomes somewhat of a zombie, there are a couple of different kinds of things that could be happening. One of them is it may simply be what's called spyware, which is reporting back as you surf the web. It's reporting back to some central location which sites you are searching, what you're searching for, what pages you're viewing, and then you may find that you're getting spam because it's unsolicited email. If you're going to a particular health site and want to know about Alzheimer's, for example, then you may start getting all sorts of unsolicited email and pop-up ads about that. Or it may be that you've got what is often called adware as opposed to spyware. They often go together, which creates all those little pop-ups. One of the most obvious symptoms of that is that your computer starts slowing to a crawl. It may crash more frequently. The machine used to run quickly. It no longer does. You may even find that you type in some websites and you're directed to other websites instead. That's one category, the spyware adware. And I'll talk about how you can deal with that in a little bit. The other kind, and this is more of the actual zombie effect that you were mentioning, is when your machine is taken over, and it may not be just to harass you, to spy on you, or to pop up ads that you don't want to see, but instead, especially for those who have fast connections like a cable modem or a DSL line, it is actually one of the machines that's busy sending out spam email to thousands of other people. These folks who are doing the spam email don't have big computer installations where they're generating it from, because that'd be too easy to bust and shut down by the authorities. So what they do is they kidnap hundreds or thousands of other machines, which they can use to generate spam mail, which they can use to coordinate to launch what are called denial of service attacks to try to flood a legitimate company with so many requests that nobody else can get through. And the zombie software that will do this essentially checks in periodically with central command, seeing what it should do. And that's certainly a problem with machines that are on all the time and connected to a high-speed connection. So if this is happening in the middle of the night and it's fairly well written, because these folks are getting a little bit more clever, they know that if you're going to have degraded performance, you'll know something is wrong, and so you're likely to eventually take steps to deal with it. So they try to do their work in the middle of the night, especially a lot of the zombie machines. So what you need is software that will look for that sort of thing. There's two or three levels of software. You certainly want to have an up-to-date antivirus program. That means that not only do you get the virus program, which often comes installed on a new machine, it might be from Norton, it might be from McAfee, it might be from others, but that's not going to do much good unless you keep the virus definitions updated so that your virus software will protect you from the most recent ones. That's part of it. Another part is to use, often these programs are free or nearly free, programs that are designed to look for this sort of malicious software. Adaware from LavaSoft or SpyBot, Detect and Remove, are two of them, and we've mentioned those a number of times before. And they will run, one program generally won't do the job. It'll find many of them, and it will do its best to remove them. Some of the software is written in such a sneaky way that it resists attempts to be removed. There may be two programs running, for example, and one of them is watching out for the other, and one program is removed. The other program reinstalls it before it can be, so it's kind of like, it was like a computer game in the early days called Robin Hood, where there were two little programs running. One was Robin Hood and one was Little John. And when Robin Hood realized it was under attack, it essentially sent a message saying, "Little John, help me," and then and vice versa. So that's spyware. Detect that. Installing a good firewall. There are firewalls that the new versions of Windows, Windows XP, the new service pack comes with a firewall, but it's not a really full firewall. It doesn't it prevents unauthorized programs from making contact with your machine from outside, but once the software is already installed on your machine, it doesn't prevent those software programs on your machine from calling home. Other software programs, including Zone Alarm, which is one that's also free for the download, can test and detect all of that. And so if you have that installed and it starts saying such and such a program is trying to contact such and such a location, you can then recognize that and say, no, don't let that happen. So firewalls, adware, spyware removal tools, antivirus software, keep your operating system updated. Microsoft, for example, which is the predominant operating system, has security releases. It's possible, especially with the most recently recently released version of Windows XP, to turn on automatic software updates so it will go periodically whenever there's a notice that there's a new security patch out. It will load it or download it and automatically install it. Several of the massive infections that happened within the last year or two are simply because people did not update their operating system. A known error was announced. 4 or 5 months later, exploits taking advantage of that error were out in the wild, and people who hadn't updated found themselves infected. They didn't have to do anything. They were just sitting there on the internet.
Yeah.
So
At the end of the day, should you just turn off the machine? I mean, is that also serve as protection?
That can, although since you're using the machine anyway, that can also be somewhat like closing the barn door after the horse has escaped. The most critical aspect is to just be proactive with your security, to make sure that you're keeping things updated, that you're not opening attachments just because Mom or Aunt Jane or somebody sent it to you. It's too bad that this whole area has evolved to the point that we have to be that careful, that you have to be suspicious, you have to be a little bit paranoid. But because there's so much money to be made, there's just more and more exploits that are being attempted. And these folks actually have a lot of incentive if they can only bring in a victim one out of 100,000, but they can make $1,000 or $100 off of that one through some kind of fraudulent activity, and they've sent out tens of millions. That's a significant amount of money.
Let's talk with a listener. Caller on line one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering, is there if you go for the paid version of Adaware or SpyBot, can you block the data miners?
You can to some extent. The paid versions generally are more successful at removing some of the deeply entrenched software, but even the free versions will, except for some of the very tricky versions of the software that resist removal, will get rid of a lot of that software that does the data mining, that does the reporting back. You just get some additional convenience and some additional power with the paid versions, and the paid versions aren't that much. We're looking at $29.95.
Well, is there any way to just block them from coming in the first place?
Well, yes, partially. There's no such thing as a perfect guard that can prevent anything from coming in, but a combination of the three things we were just talking about, really, making sure that you've got up-to-date antivirus software and that it's running. Make sure that you have a firewall running of some sort, zone alarm. The free version is fine. They have a paid version as well that's a little bit more convenient to use, perhaps, or gives you a few more options, but the free version will certainly do it, and it prevents unanticipated incoming messages or probes from having any effect. So does the firewall that's installed by default now in Windows XP, the new service pack, but it's only incoming. And those steps, along with not doing things like opening attachments that come to you without expectation, without you expecting them, will pretty much prevent all of these sorts of things from happening. Now, it's really risky to say, gee, I've done all of this and they're never going to get me, because as soon as you say they're never going to get me, chances are they're likely going to try. But we've had a number of machines that are on the Internet all the time, and we have never had in the last 3 or 4 years any sort of a problem. But we're very cautious and very cognizant of maintaining a firewall, maintaining current antivirus, and not doing foolish things like saying, oh, looks like I'll download this little toolbar and install it, when you don't quite know what it's going to do. So I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Well, I guess a firewall would keep that data miner stuff from being installed.
Yes, and a firewall such as Zone Alarm is, once it's installed, it'll keep it from reporting home. So even if you happen to have something that is reporting home, and some software, I do need to point this out, some free software that you get that is ad-supported, one that comes to mind is WeatherBug, a nice little weather utility. And it comes in a paid version, and it comes in a ad-supported version. And if you have the ad-supported version and you install a firewall that blocks it from bringing in the ads that it wants to show you, you're going to disable the program. It's going to stop working.
Well, that's fine. I know what the weather is anyway.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, you just open the window and stick your hand out, or you tune into WILL and find it that way. But the firewall will indeed prevent unwanted programs from coming in, and the more sophisticated firewalls like Zone Alarm, but unfortunately not yet, or Norton Security Firewall, there's several, but Zone Alarm is free, but unfortunately not the Windows built-in firewall, will also prevent any programs from sending information out. In fact, when you install them, they initially figure that you've got an email program and a web browser, and they'll let them go out. But other programs, the first time they try to reach the Internet, you'll get a little pop-up box saying such and such a program is trying to reach the Internet. Do you want to allow it? And if it's a program you recognize, like WeatherBug or something, you say, yes, let it. But if it's a program that you don't recognize, you say, nah, I don't think so.
Thank you.
Yes, quite welcome.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener on the toll-free line, line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I use the Windows operating system, and I wanted to ask about a pop-up that showed up that I didn't install called Error Guard. And I do these periodic Windows updates, so I didn't know if it was part of the Windows system or if it was one of those bugs that popped in, and I tried to uninstall it. I went and found it on my program directory and hit uninstall. It showed it was uninstalled, but the icon is still there on the toolbar, and it still comes up.
Well, what is often the best way of finding that information out is to go to Google, and I just did that, and I typed Error Guard, and it says the first thing that came up, can anyone tell me if Error Guard is a legitimate company? So it looks like, as I just look at this, says I've got, let's see, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to read through this quickly enough to respond to you on the air, but if you simply go to Google and do a search for just ErrorGuard, you will get all kinds of questions, pages that says, what is ErrorGuard? Every time I turn on computer, ErrorGuard pops up and wants to do a scan. Is this a virus?
Yeah.
Et cetera. And here it says, what is ErrorGuard? I would do some research on it. ErrorGuard warning. Again, there's all sorts. I've got 100 hits on this. So I'm not specifically familiar with ErrorGuard, but I would suggest that that's what you do. Go to, for now, just dismiss it. Say, don't do anything. Take a look at what ErrorGuard is. I'm not finding in my initial look anything that's obviously at this point saying that it's something you want to get rid of. Here's something that says it's excellent software for checking your PC for spyware, but, you know, I'm not sure about the site that says that either. So right now it's a little bit ambivalent, and what I would do the search. In fact, for anybody who's got some question, if there's some sort of pop-up or if you've got some odd program running, which you can do on Windows by bringing up the task manager and looking at all the processes, and if there's something you don't recognize, doing a Google search on that is going to bring up hundreds or thousands of hits, and you can look at the first half dozen or so and usually figure out, is this a okay program? Is this a program that has to be there? Is this a program that doesn't have to be there, but it's actually a good guy, or is this a bad guy program?
Well, when it popped up, I thought it was part of, I had just finished a Windows update.
Yeah.
I thought it was part of that.
No, it is clearly not part of Windows.
Okay, well, I started to hit install, and then I thought better of it and hit cancel.
Well, good. I'm glad you did that. That's always, when there's any doubt, always click on cancel. And usually the Windows update, it's very clear what's part of the Windows update. And if you get pop-up boxes, that's generally not a Windows update. Windows update goes through their website, through the Windows update.
Yeah. Well, what makes me think that it must not be an honorable program is the fact that after I hit cancel, the thing still stayed in my system. And when I tried to hit uninstall, it's still in my system. And so that makes me think it must not be a friendly
it's at least, yes, it may not be very ethical. So the other thing you can do is do a search, the same Google search, but this time add the word uninstall. So I just did a search for uninstall ErrorGuard. And again, I've got thousands of sites, but it's telling me about, you know, what's going on with this. And again, I'm not quite sure from looking at this. It doesn't seem to be obviously bad, these websites aren't saying, this is terrible, you should immediately...
So it could just be somebody who's very aggressively trying to market
it. It could be more. I can't say at this point, but I think your intuition is right. If something is suggesting that it install itself and you didn't really intend for that to happen, and it tends to be persistent, even if you've said no thanks, that's two strikes against it at least.
I enjoy your comment. I will tell you that about the only thing I could understand of your comment is Google, but following paths, ways, and all that stuff will leave me far behind. So I'll try the Google.
Some of the Google articles will be written, you know, very technically, and others will be a little bit more clear.
Okay.
And some of them will actually say, here's how you can get rid of it. You could also try, I would suggest, either the SpyBot or the AdAware and run them against your system.
Okay, well, I have both of those programs, so that's a good idea.
Run them and see if they come up with ErrorGuard.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Okay, good luck. What about going to Windows, the Windows site, and doing a search on Microsoft's Windows site for ErrorGuard? Do you think that they would do they do things like that, keep people apprised of what's going on?
They don't really try to maintain a list of non-Windows things.
Okay.
So if it were a Windows component, you might find it. This whole Google technique actually works in two different ways. If it is a legitimate Windows process, you can and you say, what is this thing? I'm not sure what it is. I see that it's running.
Mm-hmm.
So you do a Google search on that, and you'll get a number of sites. Some of them that will generally be in the first page will be a list of all the various processes, and it'll say this particular thing with this odd name that nobody would ever recognize. This is legitimate. Leave it alone. If you remove it, Windows will stop working in one extreme. Or or it may say that this is totally extra. You must have downloaded such and such a toolbar. I had a machine that was running very slowly at times, and it turns out that it was software that's installed by Dell on all their machines, It's intentionally done. It was designed so that if you were in screensaver mode with a protest, with a password that you had to type when you resumed, that none of the other software you might have been running would have any of the hotkeys would allow you to bypass that screensaver. And so the discussion on the Google reached web page was that, yes, sometimes this can start chewing up all sorts of machine cycles and make your machine run very slowly. It's not essential. You could delete it, but it's not bad, other than the fact that it doesn't seem to be engineered very well. And so I got rid of it. And
yeah.
There's no way, short of finding what people have done for researching that via the Google search, that would have been possible.
Yeah. Do you have sites that you refer to over and over again in terms of, you know, wanting to get an answer about a particular kind of software? You know what I'm saying?
Like, yes, I do. I know exactly what you're saying. So a site that will list, for example, all these odd things. And I do, but unfortunately, I can't tell you what they are. I've got them listed as favorites, and I've saved them. The way I can always find them when I'm on another machine is I'll just do a Google search for whatever I'm wanting to look up. And generally, the more popular and more successful sites will be ranked high enough to appear on the first page or two of my Google search.
Yeah.
So if I had, you know, some kind of process that was called wipeout.exe, I mean, by the name of that, I probably wouldn't want it. But if I were to just type that into Google, typically if that were a legitimate or a illegitimate program, the Google results would give me someplace within the first page or two, and I might have to check two or three of these links before I found the one that I wanted, a massive database of all of these things, and that's how I find this. So I never really worry too much about keeping track of the name, although I have them bookmarked on my own machine, but I never type it in. If I'm someplace else, I just Google it and find it that way.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line one. Hi.
Hello?
Yeah, yes. Go ahead.
I was listening to your show earlier. You may already have answered this question. I had to turn the radio off and get in my car, but I have McAfee protection on my computer.
Yes,
and it does a pretty good job of blocking stuff. But a lot of times when I'm in the middle of working on something, I'll get these pop-ups from the McAfee service telling me I need to send them $69 for an upgrade. Sometimes they'll do free upgrades of their firewall protection, but then they ask me for money for more advanced upgrades, and I've been saying no just because I think it's very expensive, but I'm wondering if I'm going to have to eventually purchase their upgrade.
Well, there may be two things going on. Certainly there is one sort of an upgrade or a subscription, really, that you will definitely want to purchase at some point, and that is for the virus protection aspect. Generally, when you get a machine, when you buy it from one of the companies or something, it will come with antivirus software pre-installed. It might be McAfee, it might be Norton, it might be another one. And generally, you have free updates by going to their website for a year. After a year, one of the ways these companies make their money legitimately is they will sell you a renewal subscription for the next year so you can continue to be updated with the most recent virus definitions. So the problem that I would have with the messages you're getting is the $69 sounds like a lot more than what you would typically pay for a renewal subscription. That's usually about $29 or so, $30.
Oh, okay.
So what it may be doing is it may be wanting to sell you an updated version of the program. Now, McAfee, unfortunately, and Norton does this to some extent too, after a couple of years, the version of the actual antivirus program you're running can no longer accept, is no longer up to date enough to accept the latest definition. So they kind of block you into buying a new version of the antivirus software at least every 2 or 3 years because you can't just keep buying annual subscription updates.
Okay.
Now, this, of course, I'm just talking about the antivirus side. If you've got the full suite of McAfee programs, including the firewall and such, the same sort of thing is true there. They may want to upgrade you. I would take a close look at what they're offering to sell for their $69.
Okay.
You can even click on it and don't put any credit card information in, but just to see where it's going to go and what it's going to ask you. This is a pretty legitimate company, of course.
Okay.
And then once you see what they're offering, check it out. Oftentimes you can go to someplace like, Amazon or any of the other online retailers and buy it for less than you can update it at the website for, because a lot of those places will give you little extra coupons and such.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. It's very helpful.
You're quite welcome.
Next, we talk with a listener on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
Hi. One site that I found helpful, it's called answersthatwork.com.
Yes, I recognize that name now that you mention it. Answersthatwork.com is a very good site.
And it tells you what all these little programs are that are running in the background and what they do and so on and so forth.
Yes, and that's one of the, I'm sure that that's one of the sites that pops up early on the Google window when you type some of these things in, because that I've used that before. Now that you mention it, the name does ring a bell. So thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Next, we talk with a listener on the toll-free line, line four. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the great show. I have two questions, one about backup and one about Windows XP. The easy one, on Windows XP, whenever any event happens or you log in, you always get those little bubble dialog boxes that will appear near the system tray, you know, like saying you're now connected to your wireless network, or you've disconnected from. Is there any way to get those so that they don't turn on or so that they don't pop up all the time?
And so I know exactly what you're talking about, and there it really depends on the particular. There is no, to my knowledge, there is no overall setting that you can change that says don't allow any program in the system tray to pop up a bubble. I think
right.
It would, as far as I know, like there could be some weird thing in the registry, but as far as I know, that would have to be done on a program-by-program basis. And so what you could try to do is click, or in some cases right-click on those various icons, bring up the actual program itself, and look to see if there's any sort of file options or edit preferences or any such, maybe it's under an options menu that you can turn that off. But my guess is you're not going to be too successful in finding many of them that will allow you to turn those off.
Okay, great. My next question is about backups.
Yes.
I have a friend of mine who has a small business that I'm helping him out with. He has about five different computers, and he wants to, he's looking at getting like one device that everything will back up to. So it would kind of need to do like, I guess, a remote backup. I didn't know what programs you'd recommend. I know they're in pretty heavy-duty industrial ones like Veritas, but those can get kind of pricey. But he basically just wants one location where everything will be backed up, and then, you know, when the backup's done, he just takes the tape off-site with him for protection instead of having to do backups. So I think right now they do a CD-ROM backup on every single computer, and it just gets kind of cumbersome for him.
Yeah, well, Veritas is certainly one of the major companies that does that, and they do have home versions and small office versions, so it might not be quite as expensive as you think, but certainly check on that. Again, what I would do to check on some of these is just do a Google search. I'm not really working for Google here, but it's certainly a good reference for backup software. We do this in a small office setting at my unit, but I've never actually dealt with it personally, because the person who set it up has been keeping track of it. And there is a client, a little software tool that's installed on each of the machines, and it's all done, since they're connected on the internet, automatically backs up all of the, well, every day it backs up changes what's called an incremental backup, and then weekly it makes a full backup. Happens in the middle of the night. This could certainly be done on a smaller home office, even if you're using if you have one connection coming in, like a cable or DSL on the network side of it, on the home network side or on the wireless network side. They're all connected to one another. So
okay,
I don't have
great.
A specific. I noticed that there is a site, and I haven't really checked this out, but there's even a site called www.backupsoftwarereviews.com. So I'd check some
okay.
of those.
Okay, yeah, I'll definitely check that out. He's, small business. He's trying to save as much money as possible, so we're trying to go with a pretty
yeah.
simple solution for them.
And I would guess that there may be some free solutions, but you may find that it's less effort and a better value to invest, $69 or $89 or something for
okay.
something that will be easier to use. But again, check the reviews, see what's
and what that was a back. review software?
I can't vouch for this. This just happens to be the when I did a Google search for backup software, this happened to be the second thing listed, and it's backup-software-reviews.com.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Next, we talk with a listener on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is about a new computer purchase. I'm pretty convinced I want to have dual optical drives, and for the same identical money, one company offers the following two options. For the drive one, you could have a CD-ROM, and drive two, a combination CDRW-DVD. The second option, which costs the same, is to have drive one be a DVD-ROM, and the second drive be a CDRW only. What parameters would make your choice for you if it costs the same? Seems like you could do the same stuff either way.
Well, it sounds like both of the options include at least one drive that can read DVDs. The DVD-ROM, you can only read the one that says it's CDRW and DVD. Presumably, unless it says DVD-RW, it's only for reading DVDs.
Correct.
And that's essential. Whichever option you have, you do want to be able to read DVDs. Some software is going to start being released in DVD format. The other option, it really isn't going to matter too much. You certainly want the ability to burn a CD, but both of these have CDRWs. One of them is in combination with the DVD drive, the other in a standalone. Of course, every one of these drives, all four optical drive configurations that you've met, if it's a DVD-ROM, it can read CDs. So every single one of these can read CDs. I think I would probably... So even the one that lists a DVD-ROM should be able to read CDs as well.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I think you're right. It's about six to one, half a dozen to the other. The first set of options you gave is going to allow you to, both of them are going to allow you to copy from one CD to another, because the DVD-ROM in your second solution does include the ability of reading CDs.
The only thing that struck me was that if I got the DVD-ROM alone, conceivably one could read from a DVD-ROM some portion of data and write it directly to the CDRW on the other side. That makes sense?
Yes, that's true. You could do that, although don't get too excited because you won't be able to copy any commercial DVDs since systems now look at the protection bit and won't copy that. But yes, you could if you had data or something that you had recorded yourself on a DVD. You certainly could copy it in part onto a CDRW. Of course, the DVD has a capacity that's nine or so times what you can get on a CD. So, yes, that would certainly
That's what I had in mind, that if another business associate with unprotected, uncopyright-protected data wanted me to give me a DVD-ROM that was their standard operation because they had a DVD burner and I only needed some portion of it, I could take it on, directly to my CD burner.
Well, one other thing you might want to look at, it's neither of these options that you mentioned, but DVD... read-write drives, or certainly DVD write drives that allow you to record onto a DVD, aren't that much more expensive now. And I might, and if you're looking at a new computer, you might want to look at one of those optical drives being able to record a DVD.
I see.
That's probably a third option that I would choose, have at least, certainly don't need to have both drives that way, but one of them would be very good if it can record a CD, and many of the drives can record not only write to a CD, but read and write, because there are read-write DVDs available, rather, as well as CDs. So you can have one that could read or write CDs and DVDs.
Okay,
and then you could make your other drive able to just read DVDs and CDs, and then you'd have everything covered.
Very good. Thanks for the call. Good luck with that. Before we go, I had one more question I wanted to ask you about. I think that Netscape has undergone an overhaul.
Yes.
Good improvements? Do you
yeah,
know
generally,
anything about it?
Yeah, generally good improvements. Of course, Netscape was taken over by AOL sometime, but the new Netscape is getting initially good reviews. Software that's kind of a cousin of Netscape, it's from the Mozilla Foundation. Firefox is also becoming very popular. I think last study that I saw had Firefox at 5% of the market at the cost of Internet Explorer. So there are a lot of new options coming out. Microsoft is feeling the pressure. They've announced that they're going to release Internet Explorer 7.0 into beta sometime this summer. Whichever one you get, it's important. Certainly if you've got a Microsoft software that you install updates. Firefox just recently had a list of 14 security issues that you had to go to the Firefox site and update.
Wow.
So you can't just leave these things alone. Software sufficiently complex is always going to have some holes. So the quick answer to your question is yes, Netscape 8 is getting a good press. I've not yet tried it.
Okay, very good. Peter, thank you so much for
joining
us.
It's always fun.
Peter Kimball is with the FAST-3 Consortium at the University of Illinois. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for FAST-3, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. This topic, Computers and You, is a topic that we take up on the third Thursday of every month. So if you've got questions that come up over the next month, well, join us in April on the third Thursday of the month here on the Afternoon Magazine. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. And what a wild ride it was today on the Chicago Board of Trade in the soybean pit, where at midday, soybeans were down as much as 16 to 20 cents, 18 to 21 lower, actually. It tumbled through some gaps at the 666 level in the May contract. When that was filled, prices continued to slide through the 658.5 level. Didn't reach the 642, but in a blink of an eye, it all turned. And on the day, prices at the Board of Trade in most of the nearbys down too, and in the deferred September 5.5 down, but then in the November and January, actually an up day there on the Board of Trade. We'll talk about what it all means with Dan Zwicker of AgriVisor Services at 2:06 Central Time on the closing market report. Let's go ahead and look at the current tick then. May wheat, a high on the day of 368, a low of 355.5, settling 366.5, up 5.5 July, a high of 375, a low of 362.5, settling 374, up 6 September, a high of 379, a low of 367.5, settling 377.5, up 4.75, December, a high of 386, a low of 375.75, settling 384.5, up 4.5 March, a high of 388, a low of 380, settling 388, up 3. May corn, a high of 224.5, a low of 221.5, settling 223.5, down 2. July, a high of 232, a low of 229, settling 231.25, down 1.75. September, a high of 237.5, a low of 235.25, settling 237.25, down 1. December, a high of 245.75, a low of 243, settling 245, down 1.75. March, a high of 250.75, a low of 248.5, settling 250.5, down 1.75. May corn, a high of 254.5, a low of 252.5, settling 254, down 1.5. May oats, a high of 156.5, a low of 152, settling 155.75, down a quarter. July, a high of 153.25, a low of 150, settling 152.5, up 3/4. May beans, a high of 675, a low of 648, settling 671.5, down 2. July, a high of 678, a low of 652, settling 676.5, down 2.25. August, a high of 676, a low of 650.5, settling 674, down 2. September, a high of 657.5, a low of 633, settling 650, down 5.5. November, a high of 638.5, a low of 616, settling 636.5, up 1. January, a high of 640, a low of 620, settling 639, up 3.75 on the day. May soybean meal, a high of 199, a low of 192, settling 196.80, down 110. July, a high of 201.50, a low of 195, settling 199.80, down 130. May soybean oil, a high of 24.37, a low of 23.32, settling 24.34, up 19. July, a high of 24.52, a low of 24.30, settling 24.50, up 11 on the day. Remember that tonight we do have an AM 580 Agricultural Outlook panel. It will be at the DeKalb Farm County Bureau Farm Bureau offices in Sycamore this evening at 7 o'clock. Todd Gleason on his way over there to host that particular panel, as well as Mike Zuzulo, Wayne Nelson, and Bill Biederman. We do hope you can join us for that panel. It will be over in time to go see the Illini play at 8:40, so don't let that stop you from joining and getting a break on what's going on in the marketplace. Prices are also in over on the Mercantile Exchange, where, Celeste, as I look at the screen, a lot of red ink there today.
Yeah, it looks like the livestock prices took a little tumble here today. Let's begin with March feeder cattle, 106.20, the high, 105.55, the low. The settlement, 105.90, that down 15. April, 104.90, the high, 103.75, the low. 104.42.5, the settlement, that down 27.5. May, 104.37.5, the high, the low, 103 even. The settlement, 103.65, that down 25. April live cattle, 89.80, the high, 88.05, the low, 88.47.5, the settlement, that down 120. June, 86.35, the high, 85.05, the low. The settlement, 85.32.5, down 87.5. April lean hog, 71.45, the high, the low, 70.15, the settlement, 70.57.5, that down 70. May, 78.90, the high, 77.70, the low, the settlement, 78.42.5, down 20. June lean hogs, 81.35, the high, 80 even, the low, 80.10, the final price, that finishing down 55. July lean hog, 79.20, the high, 77.75, the low, the settlement, 78.15, that down 2.5. March bellies, the high today, 89.50, the low, 88.40, the settlement, 89.05, that down 55. The Dow is up 3 points at 10,636, the NASDAQ up 5 at 20.21, the S&P 500, 3 higher at 11.91.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, helping to create a storehouse of possibilities and products from a single seed. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Cassandra from Asheville, North Carolina, writes, "Dear Dr. Science, a family of vegans just moved in next door. What should I do?"
If you're troubled by their presence, buy a large amount of meat and leave it lying around the house. Be sure to keep the windows open, and if you have screens, take them down. In about a week, either the county health authorities will be knocking on your door, or you'll find that the house next door is suddenly empty. By now, you'll want to dispose of that meat, and the easiest way to do that is to call 911 and tell the operator that a large amount of rotting meat fell from the sky and into your open windows. Even though they won't believe you, they'll send a hazmat team to your house, and after they've done their work and you've sprayed a few cans of Glade, things back home will be back to normal.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.